Colossians 3:11 through 3:15. The 12th talk in a series on Colossians was presented by Ron Julian on October 3, 1999, at Reformation Fellowship. The copyright for this recording is held by Gutenberg College, Inc., 1999. Gutenberg College is a non-profit organization, and contributions may be made at www.gutenberg.edu. This material may be copied and distributed in whole for non-commercial and educational purposes, subject to the inclusion of this introduction, all other rights reserved. A brief break occurs in the middle of the following recording. It is the result of the original audio tape switching to the second side.
Well, good morning. We're going to continue looking at Colossians together. We are in the middle of chapter 3. We left off somewhere around verse 9 or 10. Let me read there, kind of get us back where we were. 3:9, do not lie to one another, since you laid aside the old self with its evil practices and have put on the new self who is being renewed to a true knowledge according to the image of the one who created him. Now, I think what I would like to do is put off for another time a detailed discussion of the way Paul thinks about this old man, new man stuff. I've told you basically what I think is happening there. I would say right now that he's saying essentially he wants us to change our lives in keeping with the truth of the gospel. He wants the truth of the gospel to actually have an impact on the way we're living and change us from the kinds of people we used to be who were ignorant and foolish to those who actually understand what's true and are living with it. Now, why old man, new man, and how does that fit into his theology and all of that? I think it's worth talking about. I think somewhere along the line I'd like to take us to a couple of the other passages in the New Testament where Paul uses similar language and try to see what we can about how he uses that. But I don't want to do that today. I want to sort of continue on with the exhortation that Paul has been making. And when we get done with all of that, then perhaps we'll come back and take a week and look at some of those other passages and try to put that together. So right now, we're just going to content ourselves to notice that he uses this language as part of his exhortation. So far, he's warned them against sensuality, materialism, and then interpersonal wrath, malice, ill will, and so on. He says, put on the new, the one being remade into a knowledge in accordance with the image of his Creator. This goes back to the very beginning when Paul was praying for them. He wanted God to do something for them, and remember what he was praying is that they would come to have a knowledge of God. And in his prayer, as he laid it out, the knowledge of God was the root, was the beginning of a transformation of the way they lived. It is by knowing and understanding who God is and what he's about, what he is doing in the world, what he has promised, his character, his intentions. It's by starting to understand him that a change happens in the way we live. And as we have been talking about quite a bit through this series, for Paul, personal transformation begins with a personal understanding and embracing of the truths of the gospel. It is when I get what the gospel is about and it means something to me, I can see that it's true, and because it's true, I start to make decisions in my life based on the fact that it's true. That's when the gospel has really taken hold. So that's what he's encouraging them to do, to in essence embrace a way of living that is in keeping with the God who is. Okay, now we've been talking about that stuff a lot as we go along. Let's move on to verse 11 of chapter 3, which is basically a continuation of this sentence, where he says, he talked about putting on the new man, the one being remade into this knowledge in accordance with the image of his Creator. where there is not Jew or Greek, circumcised or uncircumcised, barbarian, Scythian, slave, free, but Christ is all and in all. Now, you're just gonna have to forgive me here while I try to back up and paint what I think is the picture. I know it's difficult as we go phrase by phrase, week by week, to kind of keep in mind the idea. What's the flow of thought here? What's the big picture? Where are we going? Because of that, it's easy when we come to a phrase like this, where there's neither Jew or Greek, circumcised or uncircumcised. I mean, okay, this is the next phrase. This is the next thing that Paul says. And you get sort of numb. It's like, okay, the next phrase could be anything. He could talk about anything, and, you know, we just move along. Ron reads the next one, he explains it, and then he reads the next one, and he explains it. And you kind of have these little pieces, these little beads that are scattered all over the table. But we really don't want that to happen. I mean, we have a choice when it comes to this phrase, because doesn't it strike you, if we've been following along, Paul's been giving this exhortation about avoiding sensuality and greed and malice and lying and all of this kind of stuff, that he throws in this phrase about there's no Jew or Greek, circumcised or uncircumcised. Is it just that every now and again Paul has this little timer that goes off and says it's about time to mention the Jew-Gentile thing? Or is there a reason? Is this somehow related to the issue in this letter? As I've been saying from the beginning, there is a problem in Corinth that Paul is writing to, but it's not so immediately apparent as we read the letter what exactly the problem is. And the question is whether this kind of language is related to the problem that he's writing about. And I think it's very possible that it is. I mean, he goes along, he says, don't lie, put on the new man where there is no Jew or Greek. Is that just a total jumping off on a tangent, or is there some relationship there? Well, let's suppose, which I think we ought to suppose, that Paul is at least somewhat coherent in his thinking here, that there is a relationship between these ideas. Can we see what that possible relationship might be? Now, I can't be dogmatic about this. There are pieces of the puzzle that we're trying to put together, and this is what makes sense to me right now. We have noticed, as we have gone along, that there are these little hints at various places that the issue of Jewish religious practices may be at the heart of this problem in Colossae. Little hints like in when Paul is talking about Christ and not walking away from Christ and holding fast to the gospel about Christ, when he describes Christ, he describes him as one who brought about for his people a circumcision without hands. And in several places, Paul uses that kind of language, and in the other places where he does, I would say that he's deliberately contrasting the ritualistic kind of outward ritual with the inner reality. The circumcision without hands that Christ brings about is a cutting away of something in us, spiritual deadness, putting to death the body of sin, various language that Paul uses, where the idea is that there is a real transformation that has happened inside, as opposed to the outward observance. Well, maybe he just used that language from out of nowhere, or possibly he used that language because he means to contrast the outward kind of observance with the inward. Remember again that he said earlier, let no one act as your judge in regard to food, drink, festivals, new moons, Sabbaths. Now, it is possible there are other religious traditions that have food rituals and would even maybe do something like a Sabbath, or at least have some sort of weekly observance that they were supposed to be involved with. But the fact is that that list, food, drink, festivals, new moon, Sabbaths, does have a kind of a Jewish ring to it. That if it, in fact, it's a situation where the false teachers in Colossae are suggesting that it is necessary to keep the Jewish rituals, to keep the Sabbaths, to keep the festivals, to eat kosher and that sort of thing, then that would make a certain amount of sense. So here we have this language all of a sudden, what seemingly out of nowhere, where he's saying there's no Jew or Greek in Christ, no circumcised or uncircumcised. Well, all I'm proposing is perhaps he's saying that because that's the issue that he has on his mind, that the disagreement among them about what spirituality ought to look like may have its roots in that idea that is the keeping of the Jewish law that is necessary to be a spiritual person. This book is not nearly as explicit about that as something like Galatians is. If you've ever read Galatians, it's very, very clear what the issue is. Paul goes back and gives the history of it. And we can go and read in Acts about what was happening at the time. There's no question at all that Paul is addressing the situation raised by the Judaizers. So it's very clear. In Colossians, it's not so clear. There are only these little hints at various spots as to what the problem might be that he's speaking to. But if it's true that there is a Jew-Gentile flavor to the issue, it would explain why he says this at this spot. Now, it's true, in this list, it's not all Jew-Gentile. There is slave versus free. But I'm reminded very much of the list, a very similar kind of list that Paul gives in Galatians 3:28, where the issue is absolutely whether or not it is necessary for the Gentiles to keep the Jewish law. And in the process of that discussion, he says, in Christ, there is neither Jew nor Greek, slave or free, male or female. Well, slave or free, male or female, that's not a Jew-Gentile thing. But I think what has happened there clearly is that he starts with the distinction that is most central to his discussion. There is no distinction between Jew and Greek, Jew and Gentile. And then he keeps going. Indeed, there is no distinction on any level. And he goes and talks about other things. I would propose that that may be the kind of thing that he's doing here. In fact, this list is even more focused. What does he say? There is no Jew or Greek. There is no circumcised or uncircumcised. Again, the Jew-Gentile distinction. There is no barbarian and Scythian. The barbarians, by that very language, I think Paul is highlighting, yes, there are those out there, pagans, Gentiles, who do not know the law that we would refer to as barbarians, but that distinction is a meaningless one at this point. And then finally, he has the slave-free distinction. So what I want you to do with me this morning is just kind of go with me. Let's say it's a hypothetical proposal. This is what makes the most sense to me at this point. But I want to explain to you what Paul's doing here in the light of the assumption that indeed this is central to the issue that he's talking about here. And let me explain to you how I would put that all together. Then in the end, you're going to have to decide for yourself whether you think I'm reading too much into it, whether this is a more general sort of exhortation than what I'm arguing for here. But I want to explain to you how I think this might all fit together, very similar to what we see in places like especially Galatians, similar to things we see in Ephesians, which is a letter that Paul wrote virtually at the same time that he wrote Colossians. So in a section where Paul is exhorting them to live holy lives without wrath and malice and so on, why is he throwing in this stuff about Jew and Gentile? Why does he say that putting on the new man involves an understanding that there is no more Jew-Gentile distinction, that no human distinctions really matter anymore? My proposal is that Paul, in his mind, sees a connection between self-righteous legalism and a contentious, unforgiving spirit. And if you think about your own experience in the world, I think you can see how that might be the case. First of all, he's already argued that a preoccupation with the ritual aspects of religion can become a distraction from the real thing. I can think of myself as having arrived, as having done what God has asked me to do because I'm eating the right things and I'm not eating other things and I'm keeping festivals and so on. It's very easy for us to fall into the mindset that I have got it together because I'm doing those things right. So it can be a distraction from the pursuit of real, genuine godliness in the world. It also promotes that kind of promotion of myself and relative demotion of everyone else. I measure up. I'm doing it right. I'm eating all the right stuff. You wouldn't catch me eating that stuff. So what's your problem? And there is absolutely no question that any religious system, including the Judaism of the Old Testament, including the practices that we find in Christianity, any religious system can end up promoting an absolutely evil kind of self-righteousness, that sense that I've got it together, I'm doing the right stuff, and therefore I have the right to look down on you. And finally, that kind of legalistic mindset, that sense that says if I eat the right things and keep the right festivals, I'm okay, I'm hiding from the more serious problem that I have. My problem is not that I have been eating wrong. My problem is not that I haven't been keeping the right festivals. My problem is a deep-seated moral corruption that is not touched by what I eat or what festivals I go to. And so I have missed the point, which means I have missed the point of the cross of Christ. If I think that if I keep all the festivals, I'm okay, I don't really need a Savior who goes and dies on a cross. But if I see myself as a moral failure who stands condemned before God, now I see why it is that I need to have a Savior who dies for me. I need to find forgiveness before God. I need to be reconciled with God, as Paul has been saying over and over again throughout the letter. So it is understanding my desperate need for reconciliation with God and the fact that Jesus brings that about, that provides the foundation then. That real understanding of my real situation provides the foundation for an appropriate relationship between me and you. It's when I can see myself for who I am, understand what God has done for me, that now I can see you in the proper light as well as myself. And that's what Paul goes on to exhort them to do. He says, "Therefore put on, as chosen ones of God, holy and beloved, a heart of compassion, kindness, humility, gentleness, patience, bearing with one another, and forgiving one another, even if someone has a complaint against someone else." As chosen ones of God. Now, we have to get this right. He's saying because we are chosen ones of God, that it ought to produce compassion and humility and so on. So this is not, wow, God chose me, I must be pretty great. I must really have it right. He looked around and said, now there's a good one. Let's go for him. That doesn't produce the kind of humility that Paul is talking about here. These are chosen ones, ones who have been chosen for the mercy of God, ones who have been chosen to be forgiven, those who have been chosen to have their sins overlooked. So, as he's going to go on and make explicit here, the idea is, in spite of the fact that I am a sinner who stands condemned by the evil that I have done and that you find in my heart, I belong to God. I am His Holy One and Beloved One. He is on my side. I belong to Him. It is thinking about that, that I, sinner that I am, have been accepted by God and have a place in His kingdom, that then becomes the foundation for humility, compassion, kindness, and so on to you. Especially in the community of believers, because not only am I one of God's chosen holy ones, but we are the chosen of God. You have been forgiven by Him just as I have. Paul puts it right on the line. I'm talking about even if anyone has a complaint against anyone else. I'm not just saying, because you're all chosen of God, you'll look around and everybody, all the believers around you will be perfect, like you. Everybody will have it together, and so you'll embrace each other in a big group hug and say, aren't we all great? He's talking about one sinner having been forgiven for his sin, looking at the faults of other sinners, and being compassionate and kind and forgiving and bearing with them. Putting up with each other. Overlooking each other's faults. Being gracious and kind. Seeking your welfare when you have done wrong to me. That's the kind of thing that he's talking about. I mean, that's it. That's what he's getting at. This is not love your brethren because what's not to love? This is, there is a reason why you ought to put up with each other. The fact is that we ought to know what he's talking about here. You and I don't always get along. I've been hanging around with you folks a long time. We don't know each other real well, all of us. Some of you I know pretty well. Others of you I don't know so well. But I know a lot of the stories. I hear you talking out there. I hear what this person is saying about this person. I mean, it's out there. It's a reality. You and I fail each other at various times. You and I are less than attractive to each other at various times. You and I do things that irritate each other. And worse, we offend each other. We hurt each other. I mean, it happens. Even amongst the community of those chosen by God, it happens. Because we're still sinners. We have a lot to learn. How are we going to react to that, Paul says? We're going to react as self-righteous legalists. I'm okay. What's your problem? Or as people who understand that we are guilty and we have been forgiven. When we look at the faults of others, I've said this, you know, how many hundred times have I said this for the old-timers around here? But Paul says it a lot, so I think we should talk about it a lot too. It's like we are a mirror to each other. I look at your faults, and the issue is, am I willing to see myself in them? Am I willing to recognize that what is wrong with you is wrong with me? Now, not the specifics. I may never have done this particular thing that you've done. But, you know, that sense of outrage and injustice that I feel at the way you have acted, other people in the world have just as much right to have that same sense of outrage and injustice against me. And the question is whether I'm willing to own that. When am I willing to own that? When I see the truth that I am indeed a sinner, and not just that, which is all bad news. The good news is what Christ did on the cross is the solution to that problem. I have been forgiven. Paul goes on to be very explicit about it. Just as the Lord forgave you, so also should you. That's the deal. That's the situation. If there's any question in your mind, the biblical picture is you are evil and you deserve to die. And God has forgiven you, so what grounds do you have for not forgiving somebody else? Are they worse than you are? So that forgiveness is okay for me because I'm not that bad, but not for somebody like that. If I think that, I haven't understood the gospel yet. I haven't understood myself yet. Remember the parable of the unforgiving servant. Jesus thinks this is a big deal. You know, the story about the servant who is forgiven this huge, crushing debt by his master, a debt that he could never pay back if he were to live 1,000 years. It is so great. And then he turns around and won't forgive the debt of another servant to him, you know, who owes him $25 or something like that. I mean, that sense, the master at the end who comes says, now, wait a minute, let me get this straight. You think that it's okay for me to forgive you $1 gazillion, but it's not okay for you to forgive the $25 that the other servant owes you. Okay, well, if that's the deal, if it's everybody ought to get what they're owed, fine, you owe me $1 gazillion, pay up. Which way are we going to have it? Is the world a place where grace ought to predominate? where God is to be praised because he is gracious to sinners? Well, if he is to be praised for being gracious to sinners, then I ought to be gracious to sinners as well. Forgiving others is one of those rubber meets the road kinds of issues. It's one of the places where you and I confront the question whether we believe this stuff or not. Whether I really believe this story about my own sin and my being forgiven. Paul goes on to say, and in all these things, love, which is the bond of perfection, literally what he says. Love is a more general issue than forgiveness. Forgiveness talks about looking at the offenses of others and overlooking them and bearing with them and being kind and not judging, not condemning, that kind of thing. Love, more generally, as I understand the biblical concept, is the idea of seeking someone else's good. We get confused by the fact that we use the word love in English in so many ways. I love you, we say to someone, and what we mean is, I feel romantically inclined towards you. I have a passion for you. I want to be married to you. I want us to be intimate together. Well, okay, that's fine. That's not what the Bible means when it talks about love. We see what the Bible means in some of the classic commandments, like love your neighbor as yourself. Think about the other person as if you were the other person. What would you want you to do for you in that situation? Jesus spells it out very clearly. Do unto others as you would have them do unto you. Think about what you would want in the situation. When I'm living in such a way that your welfare is as important to me as my own, then I'm a person who's pursuing love. That's what God's love is to us. It's not so much a warm feeling that God has about us, as it is his determination to bless us. His love is an active reaching out to do good for us. That's what we're counting on. Well, that's what it means to be people who see that quality of God as being admirable and the way it ought to be. That's the way we ought to look at each other. Your welfare is significant to me. As I have said many times, there are many kinds of bonds that can join groups of people together. We can be joined by mutual interests. We can be joined by blood ties. We can be joined by mutual self-interest. Each of us has come together because we're looking for something and we think we can get it from the group. And there are a lot of different ways in which human beings come together and form connections. But Paul sees this as the one above all. The one that is based on an understanding of who I am before God, seeing other people in the light of that understanding and pursuing compassion and love, seeing as my high calling to forgive you and to be concerned about your welfare. That's the tie that transcends blood ties. It transcends socioeconomic issues. It transcends time. If you've ever had the experience of reading something that has been written by a mature, thoughtful Christian from ages past, I have this almost spooky sort of sense of connection. Like, this is a person that I could have talked to. This is a person that I'm together with. Now, Paul says, in the New American Standard Translation, he says, let the peace of Christ rule in your hearts, to which indeed you are called in one body, and be thankful. That language, I think, as a way of translating it, that seems to have been somewhat misleading to a lot of people. We're inclined to think that Paul is somehow saying, there is this feeling of peace and contentment which Christ gives, and you should let your heart be filled with it. Let that rule. In other words, let your emotional life be filled with this peace and contentment that comes from Christ. I don't think that's what Paul means at all. Better translated, I think it's something, and the peace of Christ is to arbitrate in your hearts. It is to judge. It is to decide. It is to cast the deciding vote. Something like that. As you try to decide, how are you going to act? When you look at the issue, how am I going to respond to the people around me? Let the fact that you understand this concept of the peace of Christ, let that cast the deciding vote. I am not going to strike back. I am not going to act with malice and vindictiveness. I am going to react with compassion, kindness. I am going to seek reconciliation because I understand this thing, the peace of Christ. Now, what's that? I'm sure that many of you have heard me talk about this kind of idea before. It's not true that the Bible never uses the word peace to mean something like what we might mean by contentment, lack of anxiety, peace of mind, that sort of thing. I think that perhaps it does. But there's no question that in the majority of cases, what the Bible means by peace is the cessation of hostilities. It is the end of the war. There has been a barrier, and the barrier has broken down. There has been enmity, and now that enmity has gone away. So peace in the sense of peace between people. Not peace in my heart, but peace between you and me, peace between us and God. That's the most of the time when the Bible talks about peace, that's what it's getting at. Now, if I'm right about the Jewish legalism issue lurking behind the scenes in this whole thing, then I find the following couple of passages very interesting in trying to sort out what Paul means by the peace of Christ. First of all, in Colossians itself, back in chapter 1, we read in 19, "For it was the Father's good pleasure for all the fullness to dwell in him, and through him to reconcile all things to himself, having made peace through the blood of his cross. Through him, I say, whether things on earth or things in heaven. And although you were formerly alienated and hostile in mind, engaged in evil deeds, yet he has now reconciled you in his fleshly body through death." So, in that section, Paul is clearly tying this idea of, look, there has been this barrier between God and us, God and ourselves. We have been his enemy. Christ, on his cross, reconciled us to God, and he made peace. There has been peace established between God and ourselves. I think that's a very interesting idea. Now let me take you to another passage. This is in Ephesians, which I have argued is a book that was written very, very close to the time of Colossians. They're very similar in a lot of ways. Similar language, similar themes that go through them. And let me take you to chapter 2 of Ephesians, starting with verse 11. "Therefore remember that formerly you, the Gentiles in the flesh, who are called uncircumcision by the so-called circumcision, which is performed in the flesh by human hands, remember that you were at that time separate from Christ, excluded from the commonwealth of Israel, and strangers to the covenants of promise, having no hope and without God in the world. But now, in Christ Jesus, you who formerly were far off have been brought near by the blood of Christ. For he himself is our peace, who made both groups into one and broke down the barrier of the dividing wall by abolishing in his flesh the enmity, which is the law of commandments contained in ordinances, that in himself he might make the two into one new man, thus establishing peace, and might reconcile them both in one body to God through the cross, by it having put to death the enmity." Now, it's a little detailed in there, but I hope you can see that in his concept of peace in Ephesians, there are these two ideas. There is the idea that we have all been reconciled to God through what Jesus did. His blood has reconciled us to God. But in doing so, if the Jew has been reconciled to God and the Gentile has been reconciled to God, then the Jew and the Gentile have been reconciled to each other. The distinction between them is no longer significant because God has accepted both of them. So by breaking down the wall between God and ourselves, it has broken down the walls between each other as well. That's what I understand him to be saying at this point. Now, Jack's going to be doing a study in Ephesians, which will be well worth participating in, starting in the winter. And I hope to participate in that, and I'll find out where I went wrong in this passage, I'm sure. But for now, this is what makes sense to me out of what's happening in this passage. Well, do you see that? I mean, he's talking about, you know, the way things were, it made a certain amount of sense to make this distinction between the Jews, the people of God, and the Gentiles who did not know God, did not have the law, were off. They didn't even know about the things of God. But here, Christ has solved the real problem between every human being and himself. He has reconciled us to God, and in doing so, has reconciled us to each other. Well, so I think what's happening here then is that Paul, in a much shorter way in Colossians, he's not spelling out, he hasn't stopped to explain what he means by the peace of Christ and so on. But what he's talking about, I think, is the peace that Christ has accomplished, the reconciliation that Christ has accomplished between ourselves and God, and ultimately then between ourselves and each other. His theme in this section is that we are one because we have each been forgiven by what Christ has done. He's talking particularly about believers, how we interact with each other. If I see you as a believer, and I see myself as a believer, then what I know is that whatever things may divide us, there is an overriding thing which brings us together. We both belong to God, and we both have been forgiven. I have been forgiven, and I can't forget it. And you have been forgiven, and I shouldn't forget that either. Notice he says that we have been called in one body to this peace, which seems to me to help support that idea. The kind of peace he's talking about is this reconciliation, this coming together. We saw that very language in Ephesians. Might reconcile them both in one body to God through the cross. By being reconciled to God, we have become one. You and I are connected together because each of us is connected in a relationship of forgiveness and grace to God. So there can't be forgiveness and grace between God and me and enmity between me and you. It's not going to work that way because we have been brought together here. So what is the mindset that Paul's talking about? If all of this is true, if this is the package, then what Paul is saying, look, I, as a believer, have a place in God's kind purposes. I have a home in the kingdom of God, which means that you and I are fellow travelers. We are fellow citizens of the kingdom of God. You and I should be at peace because God has accepted us both. And the issue is whether the gospel actually means something to me, whether I am in fact a believer, so that that picture means something to me. So that I'm willing to be rebuked by Paul. I'm willing to think about the way in which I've held a grudge against you and think about how glad I am that God is not holding a grudge against me and ask, well, what does that mean? Where does that take me? Now, obviously the Jew-Gentile issue, if it's behind what's happening in Colossians, it's certainly not a big problem in this church that I know of. I mean, I'm sure there may be some Jewish blood somewhere here among us, but I'm not aware of it, and it has never been an issue. If any of you are Jewish and are holding out on us, we don't know it. So we haven't had an opportunity to have that barrier between Jews and Gentiles build up, because we, as far as I know, we're all Gentiles here. So, I mean, we've had it easy, right? I mean, we don't even have to think about it. Yeah, but the fact is that there are a lot of other kinds of barriers that can come up. Paul talks about anyone having a complaint against anyone else. And I can tell you, as I said before, there's a lot of complaining going on in this group. You've all got stuff to say about each other. I know you have. Some of you have said it to me. And I'm ashamed to say I've said some of it to you. I am not without my own complaints. Because that's one of the ways we're in this together. We are self-centered people who have a tendency to highlight the ways in which we are disappointed in other people and play down the ways in which other people could be disappointed in us. That's the way we play the game. But you see, that's part of the reason that God put us together, is because you and I, as I have said many times before, are in a sense a test of each other's faith. What am I going to do with you? What are you going to do with me? I know that people in this group would have the right to be disappointed in me in various ways. And I'm sure there are other reasons that you could be disappointed in me that I haven't admitted yet. And don't come up and tell me about them. I don't want to know. No, it's all right. Not all at once, though. If you could work it out, you know, relay kind of one a week or something. The fact is that it's real. I mean, this is real stuff. You're all smiling now, but I've seen you when you're not smiling. It's true. But is the gospel true? Would you be lost? Do you deserve to be eternally abandoned by God because of the evil in your heart? If you believe that story, then that says something. Do you believe that God reached out to you to make it possible for him to bless you in spite of the fact that that's true? If that's true, then that story which is true about you can't help but have implications about the way we think about each other. I've said this many times before, but I say it because I keep finding it. It's hard to find a letter that Paul has written where he doesn't talk about this theme, because it's so central. One of the places where I confront what I think about myself is dealing with you. So, this is all a part, as I've been saying all along, of Paul's exhortation to them to walk in a manner worthy of the gospel. That is, if the gospel is true, then certain things follow from it. And one of the things that follows from the gospel is that what is appropriate in our interactions with each other is that we forgive each other, that we bear with each other's weaknesses, that we be concerned about each other's welfare. That's what ought to be happening if the gospel is true. So, it's a big deal. And you and I, we can't walk away from this and just say, well, it's okay, because it isn't. I mean, this is hitting us right where we live. It ought to be hitting us right where we live. It hits me there. You know, I'm not saying, you guys, how come you can't get it together the way I do? I mean, I understand. I have situations in my life right now where I find it very difficult not to be bitter human beings out there in the world. I face this issue. You face this issue. What I think about that person ultimately comes back to me. What do I think about my situation? So anyway, I think Paul is very serious about what he's asking the Colossians to think about, and it's just as serious for us. Let's take a few minutes then for any questions, any comments you might have. I ran us a little late, but we've got a few minutes for anything you might want to explore.
It seems like the situation of the churches here in the area in Colossia particularly, it seems like there were lots of reasons for deep cultural skirmishes here. Jew and Greek, the circumcised, uncircumcised, those who have some sense of class in life and those who were utter barbarians. I mean, they had all of them together in this cultural mix, which was becoming the church. And some had a clue and some didn't. And I'm sure all of this was just, could very well have been erupting in the middle of their fellowship, you know. And this throw into that the slave and free. Every one of these could have been cause for a war.
Right.
And have in the last couple thousand years been reasonable causes for wars in Macedonia.
Right.
You know, so, I mean, just as a metaphor of our own lives, there's a lot going on here, you know.
Right.
And these I'm sure that these people must have Paul's words about generosity, humility, gentleness, patience. You know, those were like gongs, you know, going off in the quiet, you know, to them.
Right. Yeah, I think that's a very good point. And we want to remember that the heretical issues involved, I mean, the issues of a different gospel that's coming along and saying, you know, got to eat this way and keep these festivals and so on, I think they're tied to those kinds of things. That it's playing itself out in a community of real people with real differences, and it's easy for the cultural differences to fuel the religious ones, where I find it easy to look down on you, not only because you're doing it wrong, but because I find it easy to look down on you anyway.
Right.
And it just kind of reinforces itself.
Seems like this is really good news for people. And good news on one hand, and also difficult to hear, because we live in a culture that makes distinctions, number one. Number two, Paul's talking about this human propensity to make distinctions, and he's really taking that on. And for those people who think there's something wrong with them that there's not wrong with anybody else, this confronts that. For those who think they're not as bad as other people, that also confronts that and says, hey, we're in this together. And how I look at myself and how I look at other people is a direct reflection of how I have embraced the gospel and my own need for mercy.
No, that's right. Ultimately, the reality that's being described here speaks into a lot of situations, and it ultimately is good news. But it's the kind of good news that you have to admit the bad news before the good news gets good. I mean, you have to be willing to get over that hurdle of seeing the reality about yourself before the story about reconciliation and the parity between us and all of that starts to get good. And a lot of people will never get there because they don't want to take the first step in order to get to the second.
Well, I think the most easy distinction, the easiest and most dangerous distinction that we make is that the problem's out there rather than here.
Right.
And
right.
That's the hardest thing for us as human beings, given our moral condition, to see.
Right. Exactly. Yeah.
You spoke mostly in terms of forgiveness, and I think implicit in what you were saying is more than that, but I just thought it would be worth highlighting that this list that he gives us, barbarian and Scythian, slave and free, also involve contempt and superiority, attitudes of contempt and superiority.
Right.
Oftentimes we can excuse our sense of being better than someone because we say, I don't have anything against them. I mean, I forgive them, the fools, that we replace our forgiveness with contempt instead. And I think everything that you've said attacks that right at the heart, just as much as it does a lack of mercy and a lack of forgiveness. That we're so short-sighted that even in our concept of goodness and righteousness, our picture of something like success and value and worth and so on is culturally formed. And we're so arrogant and self-centered that we think my way of living life is the only way to live life, and I'm sure that mine is the right one. And maybe it is, but still the cross would address that issue, that even if it is so, So you got that one right. That doesn't mean that we hold in contempt the people that have it wrong.
Right. Yeah, I think in one part of what he's saying here, he is concentrating on the issue of forgiveness, but you're right, by the time he gets to the end, talking about the peace of Christ, and already having advocated that love be sort of the thing that binds them together, I think you're right. He's looking at anything that might divide them, anything that might become grounds for dismissing someone else or something like that. And you're right. That's an important admonition because that broadens it out to a lot more things I have to think about for myself, because you're right. I can say, well, no, I've forgiven you all. You know, that sometimes that's a problem. I mean, sometimes we can sort of tell ourselves, well, no, I don't want that person to go to hell. I just don't ever want them around me or anything. I mean that, of course, that's only common sense. Okay, well, let's stop there. Oh, no, we'll take one more. This will be the last one.
When it comes to mind, when I think about forgiveness, is in order for me to be able to forgive somebody or have to forgive somebody for something that I think they did wrong that hurt me, the Lord says, judge ye not, lest ye be judged. So, in a sense, when you think somebody did something wrong, and that thing that they did hurt you, you are in, it seems to me that in some way you're sort of making a judgment, and you're looking at that person, and you're putting yourself in the position of a judge, and saying, you did something wrong to me, now I have to forgive you for this thing. So if we try to sort of get ourselves into the mindset of thinking that no matter what another person does, it's not going to hurt me. So if it doesn't hurt me, I don't have to forgive them.
Okay, I'm not sure I would go that far. I know what you're saying. There, absolutely, it's true that I am not to set myself up as judge. But I do see in the Bible places where I am called upon to correct, to admonish and exhort and that kind of thing. Paul in Galatians 6 talks about restoring the one who has committed a transgression, but doing it in humility and looking to yourself and so on. So I think there has to be a place for making the assessment that something happened here that wasn't good. For me to know the difference between good and evil is an important thing. And if that's the case, then I do have to confront the question. If I recognize that a real evil happened, then the issue of forgiveness does come up. Because the Bible doesn't say, don't worry about it, there's nothing to forgive. It says, forgive. So, I think you're right. There is this line we cross where I have set myself up as judge in the sense that I feel the right to condemn. But all of us have the responsibility to evaluate, to recognize where good and evil has happened. I can't be helpful to someone who is going the wrong way if I don't recognize that they're going the wrong way. So the difference is to be discerning without being judgmental. And absolutely, that line is one that we've got to learn, I think. But there's going to come a place where I'm going to have to recognize what I don't want to be judgmental. I don't want to condemn you. That's what forgiveness involves. But I do know that something bad happened. So in a sense, there is something to forgive. Jesus would have had to die on the cross for what you did because it was bad. So maybe we're agreeing, maybe not. I can't quite tell. But that's the distinction I would make. Okay, we'd better stop.